From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, Senator Ron Johnson joins us to talk about his role in the impeachment investigations as a witness and a possible juror. Then Firing Line host Margaret Hoover hopes the reprisal of the classic show helps Americans remember what it's like to discuss issues.
Those two things combined, the partisan media combined with the partisan politics, perpetuates the sort of tearing apart of our civic discourse. And that's why what we do at Firing Line can only be on PBS, in a way.
And the career of singer-songwriter Jesse Malin has moved from hardcore punk to glam to Americana.
Over the years, I've found a way to be comfortable in who I've been, all the records I like, and put it into one record or one show. When we play live, to me, it doesn't feel like, oh, now we're doing this. Like, it all feels like me.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The impeachment investigation and hearings have dominated headlines and airtime for weeks. This morning, Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the House will be moving forward with articles of impeachment. President Donald Trump is accused of abusing the power of the presidency by requiring the Ukrainian government to investigate his political adversaries in exchange for critical aid and other political favors. The president is also accused of obstruction of justice, for trying to conceal his involvement in Ukraine, and for advising federal employees to break the law by defying congressional subpoenas. Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has been at the center of these investigations. Johnson was one of the first people notified about President Trump's alleged request to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Senator Johnson is also a potential juror and says he will not recuse himself from the impeachment hearing, despite his involvement. He joins me now by phone. Well, Senator Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Happy to be on the show.
So I think, like some Wisconsinites, I was listening to the impeachment hearing when I started to hear my senator's name mentioned quite a lot, which was both exciting and a little bit of an uh-oh moment. So take me back a bit. When did Ambassador Sondland first talk to you about the Trump administration's seemingly unusual request to Ukrainian President Zelensky?
Well, let me go back just a little bit further and talk about my involvement in Ukraine. It really started within a couple of months of my becoming United States Senator in 2011, and it was my first congressional delegation where we went to Georgia, Ukraine, and the Baltic states. And then that was followed up as I got in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I became chairman, first ranking member, then chairman of the European Subcommittee. So I've made numerous trips, I think six over to Ukraine. Certainly witnessed the Maidan, you know, 100 Ukrainians slaughtered in their quest for freedom. So I think Americans ought to have an affinity for the people of Ukraine. They're trying to shed the legacy of Soviet corruption, that type of thing. I got involved with Ambassador Sondland first during his confirmation, came before my subcommittee, and obviously was first passed out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And then as Ukraine is going through the elections, you know, former President Poroshenko lost in just a landslide victory for President Zelensky. 73% of Ukrainians voted for a complete political neophyte in President Zelensky, basically with the mandate to rid the country of corruption. And so they called the inauguration very short notice. I was the only member of Congress that could rearrange my schedule to get there. I thought it was pretty important that we had representation from Congress. Ambassador Sondland was there. Kurt Volker was there. Secretary Perry was head of the administrative delegation. So we met with President Zelensky. We met with a number of his future advisors, and we came away from that meeting thoroughly convinced that President Zelensky was a real deal. He understood that this election wasn't about him. It was really about the mandate to rid Ukraine of corruption. So we felt he's dedicated to doing that. And so Ambassador Sondland thought it was important that we meet directly with the president, which we did a couple days later in the Oval Office, the four of us, and to really encourage the president to get fully behind supporting the people of Ukraine, their new president, offer Oval Office visit, appoint an ambassador that could get strong bipartisan support to, again, a further signal of strong support for Ukraine. And I think I was certainly surprised, I shouldn't speak for the other ones, at President Trump's reaction. But my point has been his reaction has been incredibly consistent. You know, it literally starts with, you know, what a corrupt place it is. I think Kurt Volker has some paraphrased quotes of the president, which pretty well describes what the president's viewpoint was, as well as President Trump's longstanding beef that Europe just does not do enough for its own defense and certainly wasn't stepping up the plate adequately in terms of support for Ukraine.
No.
So that's kind of where the whole involvement with the Ambassador Sondland. I thought Ambassador Sondland was really trying to do the right thing and encourage the president to support Ukraine, and I supported his efforts there.
But Ambassador Sondland did say that he thought there were some real issues with President Trump's conversation with President Zelensky.
I'm not so sure that was his testimony. He certainly understood, as we all understood, that we had a real sales job to do with President Trump. President Trump had legitimate concerns. I mean, everybody recognized the issue of corruption in Ukraine. And when you're the head guy, when you're the president of the United States and you're looking at spending or releasing hundreds of millions of dollars of hard-earned taxpayer, American taxpayer money, you really should satisfy yourself that this is a country that is going to move beyond that corruption. And you know, so one of the points I kept making, and I don't think it's made enough, this is toward the tail end of the fiscal year. That money still hadn't been spent. I still haven't found out why. You know, we had, this administration had provided the Javelin missiles, which were still in place. They fortunately hadn't been used. So those Javelin missiles were still there as a deterrent for further Russian aggression with their tanks. So to me, and this is what I conveyed to President Zelensky when we're in Ukraine, let's try and minimize this hold. Let's talk about it as being a year-end fiscal issue. And we've got Senator Murphy, who's part of the appropriations process. I came back and talked to Senator Durbin, who's also on the Appropriation Committee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, let's not blow this into a big deal. We want to show our support for Ukraine. Let's not show a division. Let's just talk about, well, if the president decides not to release the hold, we'll make sure that Congress restores that funding and gives the president no flexibility. So this was being taken care of. Between branches within the branch, it's unfortunate it's blown into a whole impeachment battle.
Well, Senator Johnson, the vast majority of the corruption that you're talking about, it seemed to happen about 4 years ago. Why is this coming up now? Why is this coming up in 2019?
Well, first of all, no, the corruption is pretty much endemic. And again, I want to a certain
but
extent, he, President Zelensky...
the issue with Burisma, that's something that came up in 2015. And that's what's been cited continuously, including in the phone call that Donald Trump, President Trump,
sure,
had with President Zelensky.
Well, what drives me nuts, and this is coming from somebody who really is investigating this and taking everything I hear from everybody with a big grain of salt, okay? There are a lot of unanswered questions. And when I hear members of the media or folks on the other side say, well, that's all debunked. Well, there's certain aspects that have been debunked. But also when they say, well, there's no evidence of that. Well, there's no evidence because people literally have not done a real serious deep dive and done the kind of investigation.
When
for
you
example,
say,
as what they've undertaken against President Trump.
Johnson, I don't know exactly what you're talking about right now.
Oh, well,
when you say they're not investigating, what are they not investigating?
Sure. Well, for example, there is, and this does, you know, I've known about this document for quite some time, but there's a file document, contemporaneous memo to the file, a week after the new prosecutor general took over for Shokin, the one that was fired on behest of Vice President Biden. It's a memo about a meeting with Burisma, Hunter Biden's American legal team, that set up a meeting with the new acting prosecutor general. It says the purpose of the meeting was to apologize for the false information spread by U.S. representatives against Shokin, the former prosecutor general. Now, Burisma, I've seen the 13-page document that lays out the case to start an investigation. They're talking about Burisma basically being a conduit for laundering money from Russian interests. So there's a lot of corruption.
So you believe this is Russian corruption?
Well, there's no illegality there. For them to say there was no wrongdoing, I would just say, well, do you think it was right for Hunter Biden to take a board position in a company that was suspect in a country that is known to be corrupt when his father was the vice president and had the portfolio for Ukraine? I mean, I think on its face, that doesn't seem like the right thing to do. I certainly wouldn't let my son do that.
Well, I suppose. So I'm going to take a step back. You've said, you know, Americans, quote, we solve our political differences at the ballot box, not in the streets or through impeachment. But this impeachment process, it's laid out in the Constitution for cases of this kind where the president is accused of high crimes and misdemeanors. And let's not, you know, mince words here. He is accused of some very serious things. So are you criticizing the Constitution with this criticism of impeachment?
No, I think what I would criticize is the low level of the bar being set in terms of what's going to be considered an impeachable offense. And the fact that I don't think this ever should have been raised as an issue. I have real questions about how this whole whistleblower complaint came into being.
Do you have an issue with whistleblowers more generally?
No, absolutely not. I defend them. I'm shocked at how much retaliation there is against whistleblowers. So I'm chairman of the committee, oversight committee of the Senate. We rely on whistleblowers. So I want strong whistleblower protections, but because I am aware of a number of whistleblowers, you know, they're not all created equal. Some have personal and political axe to grind. And by the way, there is no guarantee of anonymity with whistleblowers. There's just a guarantee that they can't be retaliated against. In fact, the whistleblower statutes contemplate if an accused wants to call a whistleblower for in his defense, they'll have the right to do that. So there's no reason to keep this whistleblower's, continue to be anonymous, because he's not anonymous. Everybody knows who he is.
Well, in unmasking this whistleblower, aren't you opening them up to some real threats? A lot of the people who have testified have been threatened.
No, I don't believe that. First of all, I haven't unmasked him. Okay, others have. I mean, the name is widely known. There's a charade going on, like we don't know who the whistleblower is. I think we do. No, let's face it. This whistleblower will be celebrated, just like Professor Blasey Ford was celebrated. I don't think there's any.
She has also received a number of death threats. Well, she's had to have security with her. This gets to another point here. It seems like whenever anybody speaks out against the Trump administration, against what he's doing, or even just contradicts his timeline, they're subject to a number of threats, not just from the public at large, but seemingly in some cases, the president himself.
Well, first of all, it's a horrible place that our politics are in today where that's just true across the board. Okay, I've had my own share of death threats. You know, there were death threats lodged to people like Leah Vukmir and other members of the Wisconsin state legislature during Act 10. So that's a very regrettable state that our politics are in, but it occurs on both sides. It's unfortunately the nature of the beast right now, and I deplore it. But that's part of the thing I'm trying to speak out against, is this strong division in our country where people are just talking by each other. You know, whether you would acknowledge it or not, I will tell you the conservatives view the press as highly biased, that this president is not getting a fair shake, and that is part of the reason why the country stays divided. If we had a more unbiased, a more even-handed press, you may not have quite the same issue. So I know members of the press don't like hearing that, and they won't admit to it, but that is one of the divisions. It's one of the reasons that conservatives continue to support the president, and their support is even growing because they think this president has been treated unfairly. Take a look at the attorney for the whistleblower 10 days after the inauguration is tweeting using terms like coup, rebellion,
Senator Johnson, I understand that you have some issues with the media at large, but at the same time, especially local media, which I am, I'm talking to your constituents, but I'm also one of your constituents. We have to keep our politicians accountable. And often when we see these things that you or the president have taken issue with, these are articles that are just pointing out that what he said or what someone said isn't accurate, that it's not true.
But how do we
keep people accountable?
So what I say, the bias in the media is revealed. And by the way, I'm very accessible. I try and have as good a relationship with the media. We need a free press. It's vital. But an unbiased free press would even be better. But the bias in the media is revealed far more often in what they don't report, what they're not curious about, versus the sometimes very overt bias in what they do. And it's one of the reasons I think President Trump was talking about Biden. He'd just gone through a special counsel investigation on a completely false charge of collusion between his campaign and Russia. And he looks at that, and there are questions. Was there any kind of DNC involvement with actors in Ukraine? Could have that been part of what caused him to get a special counsel? He was just asking, I think, any human being who'd gone through that torment, well, I mean, you've given me a special counsel. You investigated everything I've done. why don't you look at what Vice President Biden did? I mean, to me, that's just kind of a human reaction. And now we're impeaching somebody on the basis of what I consider a very sympathetic human reaction.
Well, he conditioned a number of things on these investigations. He conditioned critical aid to Ukraine, a country who you believe the United States should actively, vociferously support.
So when I asked the president about that before my trip on September 5th, I talked to him on August 31st. He was, again, very consistent. The reason he was looking at this was because corruption in Europe's not stepping up the plate. I'm the one that raised the issue. Is there some arrangement that, you know, if Ukraine does something, you'll provide, you'll lift the hold? And he vehemently, angrily, adamantly denied that.
That's not what the transcript said.
Toward the tail end, well, they didn't even know about the holdback. I don't think there was a holdback there in July.
Let me finish.
At the tail end of my conversation on August 31st, the president wrapped it up saying, Ron, I got to deal with the hurricane, but I hear what you're saying. We're reviewing it right now. I think you're going to light my decision. So on August 31st, it was already under review. He was already leaning toward releasing that hold. He released the hold on September 11th, and there was no conditions placed on it. He released it. So, again, I understand how the press is putting the worst possible construction on everything. This has been blown way out of proportion. It never should have risen to an impeachment trial. This sausage-making process of foreign policy didn't have to be revealed.
That gets back to this point. You're considered a fact witness in this trial, but you also have said that you intend to be a juror. Now, in any other courtroom, that would be considered incredibly unethical. Why do you believe it's ethical for you to act as both a juror and a fact witness in this case?
Do you know how many fact witnesses might the other senators be?
Why would it be ethical for them to be there either?
Because this is not a jury trial. This is a political process. I'm a United States senator, and the people that elected me deserve representation in this process. They deserve my voice. They deserve my vote.
Don't they also deserve a fair trial?
There's absolutely nothing unethical about it. I wonder how many members of the press has asked Senator Murphy whether he's going to recuse himself, because he's also a fact witness, because he's with me meeting with Zelensky. No, he should not. He should not recuse himself.
Why?
Because it's not a jury trial. It's not the same type of thing.
Not as ethical as a jury trial. I don't understand why it's more ethical.
This is a political process. This is not an Article III trial. It's a political process.
Does that speak to whether or not it's ethical?
There is nothing unethical about me having knowledge of something. And by the way, a lot of senators have knowledge about what's happening with Ukraine and the funding and everything else. But there's nothing unethical about me being potentially a fact witness, and I've already provided what I know, and then actually sitting in the Senate as one of the senators that will decide to vote whether to impeach us, to convict this president or not. There's nothing unethical about that at all.
It's in no way a conflict of interest in your mind.
No.
Okay. Well, Senator Johnson, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, happy to do so. Have a great day.
Republican Ron Johnson is the senior U.S. Senator for Wisconsin. He's a member of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations and the chairman of the Subcommittee on Europe and Regional Security Cooperation. He is also a member of the Senate's Ukraine Caucus. You can find more of NPR's impeachment coverage at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll talk with Margaret Hoover, the host of the recently restarted PBS show, Firing Line. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The iconic PBS program Firing Line with William F. Buckley ran from 1966 to 1999.
The show was known as a platform for debate and discussion, for everything from politics to philosophical issues with experts. With over 1,000 programs in the archive at the Hoover Institution, it has quite the legacy. 20 years later, political commentator and analyst Margaret Hoover leads the new reprisal. Firing Line with Margaret Hoover maintains the character of the original show, featuring guests from the left and right sides of debates to have a rigorous and civil exchange of ideas. Margaret Hoover was in Milwaukee last month for a Milwaukee PBS event and took some time to speak with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski on site. Hoover begins by explaining what excited her the most about taking part in leading the new Firing Line.
Many people don't realize it was the longest-running television program in television history with a single host. It lasted even longer than Johnny Carson. So I was, as a young person growing up, aware of Buckley, aware of Firing Line. My parents watched it from time to time. But I was, you know, sadly young enough that I wasn't part of the conservative movement that came up through William F. Buckley's direct fingerprints. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a personal relationship. I didn't know William F. Buckley. I've met his son since then and find him delightful, and I'm very grateful for his support for the program. But I didn't, you know, I didn't know Buckley. But I've come to know him, I feel, very intimately, because I have gone through scores, hundreds of his old programs. There are 1,504 episodes of Firing Line, and they are all archived at the Hoover Institution, which is a public policy think tank founded by Herbert Hoover, my great-grandfather, at Stanford University. So just watching these old programs, I've gotten such a great sense of Buckley and his wit and his affect and his sense of humor and his quick-mindedness. I mean, this was the thing that even he gave himself credit for. If he was nothing else, he was quick. He was very, very quick on his feet. And so I've gotten, I feel like I've really gotten to know him in a way, but you know, we're our own show. We're different. I'm not Buckley. I'm not trying to be Buckley. I have no interest in being Buckley. Nobody can be Buckley. I think many people have discovered that nobody can be Buckley. And what we are trying to do is riff from something that he bequeathed us, which is a long-form exchange of ideas where you can really dive deep into issues of the day that are important to public policy and important to all of our lives. And it's sort of amazing that television and news and media have become so fast, and the news cycle has become so crowded that news consumption is crammed full of things that often are just skin deep. And so what I found in the sort of resurrection of Firing Line is that what's old is new again. You know, there was a kernel of wisdom in what Buckley was doing that we've kind of forgotten. And it's just take a moment to have a long-form exchange of ideas, by the way, with people that we don't always agree with. Because that contest of ideas provides for a far more rich and nuanced approach to issues. And by the way, I think that's what we recognize, especially at a national level, we're all deeply missing.
What are your biggest influencers or inspirations of hosts from different programs that you look to for inspiration, for ideas? Who did you research when you were looking into playing this host role?
I researched Buckley a lot because nobody's really done this. Only Buckley's done this. But I just think you have to be yourself, right? I don't think you can pretend to be anybody else or study anybody else or try to riff from anybody else. I think you just have to. So I can't say there's particularly one person that I look to in terms of their performance ability. I just think it's the kind of thing that the only way to learn to ride a bike is to start riding a bike.
What have you found to be pleasantly surprising in this new role for yourself with this new challenge of being a host?
I mean, what I've found is, shockingly, there's nothing else like this on television, even still. And the audience has really responded. I mean, people like being able to hear, see different people and engage in what is a respectful exchange of ideas. I think that people are very thirsty for content. I think people are thirsty for smart conversation. I think people are thirsty for a well-researched approach to issues. People who are interested in a pragmatic approach to solving problems. So, I mean, that was the thesis. That was our central thesis. But it's been proved, it's been proved correct.
What topics intrigue you the most? Do you also embrace the challenge of interviewing someone about a topic that you're not super familiar with? It's pretty impossible to be an expert on everything of every guest that you're going to talk to. So what's some of the things that you've found the most refreshing to research and to look into?
It's truly driven by what's interesting to me and what I think is relevant. I mean, I have been, just to give you a small example, I have been deeply concerned about election security. going into 2020, and deeply concerned that in the context of our current debates, and I don't mean just this impeachment inquiry, but I mean even against the backdrop of the Mueller report, I mean even truly since the 2016 election, it has been abundantly clear that we were completely sideswiped. We had no idea this was coming, although in hindsight, it turns out that the previous administration did know some and, you know, had to grapple with difficult and nuanced considerations about how much to share with the American public. I think in hindsight, they probably should have shared more. So this needs to be talked about. And I've been frustrated for such a long time that we haven't talked about it. We finally did a really good election security program with Mark Warner, who we had done a previous one. We had a Angus King, who is an independent senator from Maine, on the Senate Intelligence Committee right around the time the Mueller report came out. But we also finally sat down with Mark Warner, who's a senior senator from Virginia, former governor of Virginia, and co-chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, along with Republican Richard Byrd. And we're able to really do a deep dive into what are our true vulnerabilities still on the industry side, on the legislative side, and from the executive branch. And by the way, from the Defense Department, because that's actually a big part of our cyber, our ability to be proactive through cyber defenses is actually going to end up being a really big part of 2020 and securing our infrastructure in 2020. So impeachment inquiries are really important when they only come around, three times in the history of a representative democracy. On the other hand, the real challenge about ensuring that the result of 2020 is fair and accurate is ongoing.
So one thing that I think can be a real hindrance for people wanting to know more about these topics is they're complicated, right? And if they're only getting a surface level headline or a quick 5-minute newscast or something, they don't often know where to start to dive deeper. So when you're preparing your questions for your guests, how are you coming at that? Are you thinking of this person sitting on the couch watching your program?
1,000%. I mean, every interview is constructed in the way of a story. Is how we think about it. And I start by trying to understand and introduce the guest to the audience in a personal way so they know what their credentials are and why they're sitting down in front of us and why they have reason to be sitting down and diving into whatever issue it is. And frankly, I like to connect with people. Like, I'm interested in people and who they are and what motivates them and why they're sitting in front of me doing what they're doing and what's gotten them to the point. So I've done a lot of research into them personally and try to find ways of you know, there's always something you like about people. And so I try to find the things that I like and that we can connect about and try to evoke that. So, because then I feel a personal connection to them, but that comes through on camera. The audience does too. And then we try to tell a story about the issue. I mean, there's always, you know, for me, 3 or 4 things that I want answered or I want to get out of it or I want to see if the guest will play with. And that's sort of where I'm going. There's an arc to the conversation. And hopefully that makes the issues less menacing and more enjoyable.
With the original firing line, a big point of it was, quote, a balanced exchange of opinion, you know, and the media landscape is ever more combative and the spirit of respectful debate and of public discourse is not what it once was. How do you think we can regain these skills as Americans?
Look, I think actually Americans have it. I think we don't in the media. I think we don't in Congress. I think we don't in parts of the academy. What I am deeply concerned about is that we've created this, you know, there is a hyperpolarization in our politics and in our media that is actually doing us an enormous disservice. It's actually tearing us further apart. And by the way, the Russians are leveraging natural wedges in our society, and they're playing on them. I mean, we saw that in the Senate Intelligence Report that came out 2 weeks ago that demonstrated that the kneeling in the football team in the before the Pledge of Allegiance and the Star Spangled Banner at NFL games actually was amped up 10 times by Russian bots. This may not have even been a social issue that could have torn us apart on our respective cable news channels if we hadn't been so vulnerable to social media disinformation campaigns by foreign actors. So I think we've also created, frankly, a cycle of partisan media that is perpetuated by the profit margin. And we've also have the thing that Paul Ryan called the conservative industrial complex. There's one on the progressive side too, a progressive industrial complex. In other words, people who are invested and whose livelihoods are invested in continuing to make money on the polarization of our politics. And I think those two things combined, the partisan media combined with the partisan politics, perpetuates the sort of tearing apart of our civic discourse. And that's why what we do at Firing Line can only be on PBS in a way. I mean, we're privately funded. We don't have to race to the next break for a commercial. We can take the time to let an interview breathe, a set of ideas breathe. I have time to ask a follow-up question and then another follow-up question and then the follow-up to that follow-up. And so you get a really good sense of people and their ideas and what the issues are, whether it's Medicare for All or 2020 election security or gun control, right? We have the ability to do that, and the profit model hasn't demonstrated, although I think it'd be highly profitable. PBS has created a space for us to do that, and that's why I'm so grateful.
How does it feel for you to be part of, quote, the media that is often vilified and targeted these days for doing their work?
You know, it's interesting. The only reason I pause is because until this point in my life, I'd never considered myself a journalist. I haven't been. I'd been a commentator. I'd been an analyst. Even though I'd been on camera, I was never responsible for sort of unfolding the truth or trying to get at the truth with a guest. Mm-hmm. And it is more of a responsibility, and I take it really seriously. And look, the media is in the Constitution. The press is in the Constitution, protected in the First Amendment. And the attacks, mostly against the media, are coming from the right. And I have a very difficult time with the right, which has, at least for the time that I had been active in politics, working in Republican politics in the House of Representatives and in the executive branch in Washington, D.C., always being very quick to wrap its arms around the American flag and the Constitution. Suddenly having a problem with the First Amendment or blaming the media for the problems that its party has come into, it doesn't sit well with me. And I think, again, it points to the problem that I mentioned earlier, which is this problem of partisan, hyper-polarized, hyper-partisan media is not serving our country well.
What are your goals in what you do with this program in trying to help shift that in what way you can?
Look, I mean, I think we're new. This is just the beginning of our second season, or we're approaching halfway through our second season. But I think the goal for the program is to continue to grow, to grow our audience. And one of the challenges we find now, and bless Milwaukee airs us at 7:30 on Fridays, and we're very, very grateful. And we have a pretty robust following here in Milwaukee, which we're very happy about. But we want 100 Milwaukees. And, you know, so people can know where to find us and know how to tune in and can find us on all these multiple channels. So we're just really, we're growing, right? We've started, we have a great product, and we want to get the word out so we can engage more and more minds.
Margaret Hoover is the host of Firing Line with Margaret Hoover on PBS. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski while she was in town for an event at Milwaukee PBS. You can hear more of their conversation at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then singer-songwriter Jesse Malin stops by the performance studio to play some tunes from his latest album, Sunset Kids. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
They say you got a chemical heart. They try to prove it different is the hardest part. They say it's on the tip of your tongue. You've been making up excuses since you were young.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Jesse Malin has been playing music professionally since he was 12 years old. His first band, Heart Attack, was hardcore punk and active in the New York scene in the early 80s. He then became the lead vocalist for D-Generation, a glam punk band. Since the early 2000s, Malin has been a solo act. Throughout his career, he's collaborated with people like Bruce Springsteen, Ryan Adams, and Billy Joe Armstrong. And his newest album, Sunset Kids, was produced by Lucinda Williams. Malin was in Milwaukee last month to perform at Shank Hall. He and his guitarist, Garrett Cruz, came into the studio to talk with the Lake Effect's Bonnie North and to play some tunes from Sunset Kids. This is Chemical Heart.
I don't want to be your stepping stone. They say you got a chemical kiss. You're breaking down the atoms to get your fix. You're looking like a knife in the heart. Wishing that it's different is the hardest part. Singing na na na. Singing na na na.
Chemical Heart in Lake Effect's performance studio. Jesse Mallon and Derek Cruz, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank
God,
you.
From the new album, Sunset Kids. And I got to tell you, Jesse, I love it. What a great album.
Oh, thank
and I
you.
Know it came out of a lot of hard stuff.
Yeah, it was done during a crazy time. I mean, you know, it was just one of those years where just a whole bunch of people close to me just passed away. Started with, you know, one of our guitar players that had played with us. And actually, the whole first conversation we had with its producer, with Lucinda Williams, was at the last Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers gig. She was opening. And then we talked the next day about making this record, and we made a whole plan. And she was close with Tom, and a few days later, as we know, he passed away. But yeah, I lost my dad, and you know, it's a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, life is for living, and music is to celebrate life. That's the way I see it. But a lot of this record and the title is to celebrate some of those people's lives.
Yeah, and what I love about knowing that is that the album isn't a dirge. It doesn't sound like, oh my God, everything's terrible, and let's go jump off the bridge right now. But all of that, remembering and loving and joy and sorrow, it's all mixed in.
Yeah, well, that's what I think, you know, that's what life is, fortunately and unfortunately. But I think for me as a writer, I always didn't just love stuff that's just blindly happy. I think that, you know, sometimes through a dark tunnel, there's a lot of interesting stuff. And of course, hopefully there's some light at the end.
Well, yeah. And, you know, sometimes I think the dark stuff is sometimes the most interesting because you can't have the light stuff without it.
Yeah.
You know,
the duality, definitely. But kind of wrote, I guess, about 25 songs for this record. So every time Lucinda Williams would go on tour and we have a little break, I'd have a couple more songs. Something else would happen, good, bad, ugly, whatever. And then I'd come back in. And so we kind of was tough narrowing it down to 14. It's like your kids. You love them all equally. And it's like, you know, so having a producer and her husband, Tom Overby, who's her manager, are almost like editors in a sense, as well as inspiring and helping with the process of creativity. I think they also can tell you, all right, stop, that's enough, you know.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about working with her as a producer, because you've known each other a long time just as colleagues. And so what was it like going into the studio with her in that role?
I guess, you know, you think you know somebody, they're your friend. We were friends, like you said, for a bunch of years. We met in the early 2000s in New York at a jazz club. I was a fan first, though. You know, I got that Car Wheels on a Gravel Road record, and I went to a couple of those shows while I was in my old band, and it was very different for me, but it was so amazing. And as a writer, her, you know, eye for detail, and as a singer, such a unique, powerful voice. So I forgot about that for a while, just being a friend. You know, you don't totally forget, but then when suddenly it was time to like show her my songs, and I went to her house in California where her and Tom live, and you know, just brought my notebooks and my acoustic guitar and sat around her kitchen table, which always is a good place to kind of air out some songs, cook them up. And I was like, suddenly realized I was nervous. But, you know, it made me set a bar a certain way, knowing I'm going to bring a song in to Lucinda Williams, not just my friend Lucinda. Like, it made me think about every word, every note. And that was helpful. Plus, I'd call her the lyric doctor. Sometimes I write 6 or 7 verses. So we'd sit in the kitchen of the studio or her house, and she'd be like, no, these are the 3. And they say, you know, it's all about the details. You know, God is in the details. And so she would make little changes, you know, had some line in the next song we're going to play about like a lonely, closed down city on a Sunday and all the stores are closed, I wrote. And she said, no, all the liquor stores are closed. You know? But also, you know, we track to tape still. We're into that warm analog. And on a reel of tape, you can only fit about 3 takes. So the band would be cooking away in the tracking room. She's in the control room with Tom, her husband, and they're in there. And we come running in to see if we nailed the song. And if she was moving her hips and dancing and shaking, we kind of knew we had the take. And that turned out to be a good meter for the project.
I love the idea that you do it to tape still and that you really are limited by that. So you can't just keep doing iteration after iteration after iteration.
Yeah, it makes it, you have to
commit. Make choices. Yeah.
But then the upside is there's a warmth to tape, at least for rock music, that with drums and guitars and the vocal, that something about that 2-inch tape kind of just gives that extra stuff. Or at least that's what we grew up with and are familiar with. And I've done records straight to digital. And then we have, you know, later on you go into Pro Tools and you have those options to go crazy. But yeah, we starred the record in L.A. at a studio called Dave's Room in North Hollywood that Lucinda had worked with this guy for a long time. And he had also did Bob Dylan and he did Tom Petty, Wildflowers. But the guy, David Bianco, had also did my first record on EMI, Degeneration, my first punk band, rock and roll band. And so it was a full circle to connect with him, and he passed away.
I was going to say, isn't he one of the people
you
lost?
Yeah, he passed away in the middle of making the record. But we started out to test it around Christmas time, and Lucinda and I both get sometimes the holiday blues, and we thought, let's just be workaholics. We'll work through the holidays. We're in L.A., Christmas, no snow, but a lot of fun playing music, and kind of, you know, it's a real different feeling.
So tell me about Room 13. That's the next tune we're going to hear.
Room 13, the next song I'm going to play, is probably one of the earlier ones I wrote for the record. Not the first, but definitely one of the first songs I brought to Lucinda, like I was saying before about, you know, little details and things. And her and her husband contributed a bit. We'd sit there and throw lines back and forth. But for me, when I had the song, it was kind of about those moments, and hopefully everybody gets these, where you're away from the gadgets and away from the phone and the computer and maybe even other people, sometimes on a long journey on a train or an airplane. And in this case, it was in a hotel. I get that, where, you know, you're kind of just out of your comfort zone and forced to reflect and think and really feel what matters most in this life. And it's called Room 13.
Shadows on my wall, in voices in the hall, I'm making up my own scene, hanging out in room 13. I pull down the blackout shade and watch the TV start to fade. Deadbolt on the lock, and I unplug the digital clock. Well, I spent some time in a hotel room thinking about love, and I walked away like those others do. Oh, when it's not enough, the walls are paper thin, in the scene everybody sins. All the liquor stores are closed, and I'm sleeping with the ghost. Well, I spent some time in a hotel room thinking about love, and I walked away like those others do. Oh, when it's not enough, I just wanna do the right thing, but I get dragged down on the wrong side. Telephone, she asked me when I'm coming home, and I'm falling somewhere in between what she says and what she means. It was something that was said before the phone went dead, like the sound of the falling rain and the rumble of a train. Well, I spent some time in a hotel room thinking about love, and I walked away like those others do. Oh, when it's not enough, thinking about love. Thinking about love. Mm-hmm.
Room 13, Jesse Malin with Derek Cruz in Lake Effect's performance studio. Such a beautiful song.
Oh,
and it, as I'm sitting, I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking about actually a line from the last song on the album. I know you're not going to play it, but in My Little Life, and all that I want is something I'm not.
Yeah.
Is that still true?
Well, with that song, to be honest, I was kind of writing through some other people that I know, some close family friends. I don't know. I don't want to give it away too much, but somebody in my family that life is just hard. I don't know. I'm sure everybody knows somebody where just going out the door and just doing, you know, basic things that some people find so easy are such a struggle, and they might seem quiet and shy, and it comes off as that they're antisocial or nasty. And so it's just those people that carry that kind of burden and every single day having to battle that. So
it's tough stuff.
But I mean, I can't, that song is about somebody I know, and I sing it from my person, you know, from my perspective. I can't really write a song unless I can find some part of me in that thing. And there's definitely that, you know. So I think I've felt those feelings and stood there and been like, you know what, this is not working, and I don't know what I'm going to do, where I fit in this whole world, you know.
Oh, the existential angst, absolutely. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it really is. And I think we all suffer from that at some point. I don't think you're really kind of engaged in the world if you're not.
Yeah.
If you don't. It's
well, you
finding
get it.
Your way
it's
back
nice
from
chatting
it.
With you because, you know, every day we try to keep positive. I always say that something I got from this hardcore band, the Bad Brains, PMA, positive mental attitude. And just walking in with you and meeting you, I could tell you have that energy and that thing. So we're taping this early, and you just giving us this this positive light. So it's nice to see that. I feel you think that way, too.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, I think it's one of the reasons your music resonates for me so much, because it's like, oh, there's a kindred spirit. I know him at least a little bit. You know, there's
right.
There's something in there that I recognize. And the other thing I want to say about this album is that what I love about it is you've managed to incorporate kind of all of your musical journey in there. So I hear punk.
Yeah.
I hear, you know, the hardcore rock and roll. I hear a lot of, and the Americana stuff. All of it kind of finding interesting different places to surface and then come back in. And I love that mix. Was that
well,
you,
it's interesting.
Lucinda?
You say that. I mean, there's certain songs that people like. There's a song I wrote with Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day,
which is fabulous.
that Tom Overby, Lucinda's husband, one of the producers, felt that it had to be on the record. And it was originally written for a side project that I do with the guys from Green Day called Rodeo Queens. And it was going to be the next single. But and that's how we did it, me and Billy. And then at the last minute, I had to call him up and say, they want to put this on this record. Are you okay with it? And he was totally cool. But, you know, years ago when I came out of bands like Degeneration and Heart Attack, my teenage and bands in my 20s, and then I went solo, it was like very extremist and militant. You know, it was the early 2000s, and I just played acoustic and kind of stuck to the whatever label, songwriter, Americana, you know, guidelines of the box I was in. But over the years, I've found a way to be comfortable in who I've been, all the records I like, and put it into one record or one show. When we play live, to me, it doesn't feel like, oh, now we're doing this. Like, it all feels like me, and I feel comfortable in that. Found a way to weave it in together that seems to work. And this record, I think, is that way. Because my favorite records have always had the quiet, sad songs and then the loud, crazy ones. And, you know, whether it be even those classic rock, you know, records, they always had the ballads that my father liked.
I mean, the Strangers and Thieves that you're talking about, that one I was hearing just the way the band was working and everything. It was like there was Tom Petty in there. There was like an homage to that. You could hear that kind of, it's like the great American rock and roll, like we're on the road and we're doing this. And the song made me really happy.
Oh,
you know, it was just like, God, I just want to play this over and over. And I want to put it in my car, and I just want to play that one over and over again.
That was the first thing that came out, I think, the first they start to play it on satellite radio, and it was like, wow, well, all right, let's see. This one's pretty rocking, but it got a good response, and it's fun to play that one live, too.
I bet it is. You know? I bet it is. You know, I just want to thank you guys. I know you're getting ready to get on a plane to go off to the next thing, but I want to thank you so much for stopping in.
Oh, thanks for having us.
And playing some music for us, and I hope you'll come back and, you know, bring some more of the band. We can fit some more people in here. It'd be great to do that. But what are we going to hear going out? What's the last
tune? We're
going to
hear a song called Shining Down. It's off of our Sunset Kids record, and it's one of the first songs I wrote. I wrote this when I was visiting my dad down in South Florida in a little motel, and it's kind of one of those ones that's pretty autobiographical, I guess.
We never got a break. We live with our mistakes. Just icing on a cake and some cold heartbreak. Sentimental kids with movies in our heads. We never figured out why she had to.
Singer-songwriter Jesse Malin, along with his guitarist Derek Cruz, performing Shining Down from his newest album, Sunset Kids. Malin and Cruz stopped by the Lake Effect studio last month after playing a gig at Shank Hall to talk with Bonnie North. You can hear all three songs they played for us at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Becky Mortensen, Bonnie North, and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week, with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Chuck Quirnbach and Susan Bentz this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
Keep on shining.